Hello, Dominic Arkwright here, back again with Health Today. Hope you're well. We've got an hour of news, views and music to help you make the right decisions about your health and your treatment. We're talking, as per usual, about everything to do with our health, our lifestyles and our health service. Today, the worrying story of Ingrid and the effect that alcohol had on her liver.
I diluted the whiskey 1 to 3 with water and I drank it all the time, just drinking on my own, by myself. The doctors were saying, oh, we wish we had a liver for you, we wish we had a liver for you. I didn't think it would ever happen. I didn't think I deserved it because I'd done it to myself.
We'll have some tips on how to keep your liver in good shape. Also, we're talking about falls and how you can exercise to minimise the damage they can cause in later life.
So we're covering people that have had falls and are recovering from them, and we're going to try and get them rehabilitated from the shock and the effects of a fall. It covers also people that have got this fear of falling.
And we meet Jimmy.
Jimmy, come. Jimmy, sit. Sit, good boy. And down. Down.
The dog who visits nursing homes as part of what's known as Pets as Therapy. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. We've spoken on this programme before about alcohol and how we should try to moderate our drinking. Today, we're going to find out the potential consequences of drinking too much. Ingrid is in her 60s. She seems fine now when you meet her, but 5 years ago, she had a liver transplant and alcohol was the cause. It's a disturbing story and we'll have some advice on what you can do to look after your liver and drink sensibly after this. But first, here's Ingrid.
When I was raising my children, I didn't drink at all, just socially drinking with friends, and it only got worse, I think, the last maybe 4 or 5 years, that I felt just very alone. My children had grown up, some friends left, and I was suddenly in the big house on my own, just work and myself, and I started drinking more and more and more. When I got home after work, just not to think, just to be quiet in myself. And it just got out of hand.
So talk me through a typical day during those years then. And what did you drink and how much and when?
I drank whiskey. I diluted the whiskey 1 to 3 with water. And I drank it all the time. That was, apart from coffee here or there, the only stuff I was drinking, just whiskey diluted with water.
Including in the mornings?
I think I did in the mornings as well. Even though I can't really remember that anymore. I don't think I remember much anyway from the last couple of years maybe. I thought I was all right. I was still working. Nobody said anything at work. And, you know, thinking back, I feel so guilty. I've been driving, looking after people as a health carer. It's just absolutely dreadful, but I just did it until it was just too much.
You thought they wouldn't notice there was nothing wrong, or you thought there was nothing wrong?
I thought that nobody would notice. I thought I was hiding it very well. I was just drinking on my own, by myself. I remember I stopped drinking whiskey because people noticed and it smelled on my breath and you could see it in the glass. And so I swapped to vodka, because it was white and it looked like water or lemonade. And I thought, I'm getting away with it. But I didn't, because my body gave in.
Did you feel that you were drunk? Or did you just get on
with
life?
I felt numb. I thought I was feeling the hurt and the pain inside me. And I felt quite numb and not really thinking, just getting on with every day. I was not in a stupor or so that people would say, oh, she's drunk. I could speak and I could finish my day and my tasks in the day. But somehow I was somewhere else. And the last year I stopped eating properly, because somehow the drink was just enough. As long as I had a glass of vodka with water in me, that was okay. A bit of cereal in the morning, an apple here, sandwich there, no more proper meals. And I used to love cooking for myself and for the whole family, but I just gave that up. It was just me anyway. And I had no appetite left. Just drinking just killed it all off. And that was, then I noticed that was not right, because I went really downhill. And I didn't want to get up in the morning. I could easily stay in bed when I had a day off work. Could easily stay in bed all weekend. And, you know, not eat, not go shopping. And if nobody looked after me or came around and said, "I'll come and see you," I wouldn't even get out of bed. And my son found me just lying in bed. It was one morning, probably almost lunchtime. And he just got me out and took me to the doctors. And I stopped then drinking suddenly, just there and then, because I was found out. I was completely ashamed and shocked and just didn't want to do it anymore.
You were ashamed, obviously, by being found in that state by your son.
Yes, and to behave in such a way. I was supposed to be a responsible person and being responsible and caring for other people. And neglecting myself so badly was bad.
Had you thought about what it was doing to your health by that time?
No. I didn't think it would kill me. You don't think anymore. Everything is so numb, the feelings just disappear. And any worry that I had just got away with another drink. It's really silly. I can't even say it now. It's just really, to think back, I behaved in that way. It's really unbelievable.
Talk me through your treatment then. From the moment you saw that second doctor, how did it progress?
Well, when he examined me and heard my story, they called the ambulance straight away and I was taken to Addenbrooke's Hospital. And they drained fluid from my stomach. I think it was 12 litre the first time they drained out of me. And I had to repeat that in regular visits then, about every 4 weeks, then 3 weeks, and by the end I had to go weekly to have at least 10 litre drained, because it just filled up again. The liver was so shut, just was nothing doing. That was about it, and because I had to go to hospital and had this procedure done quite often, I caught infections in the hospital, and that made me very ill. I nearly died because I had two infections at the same time. And then I was very weak. I looked like a skeleton. I lost all my weight. I think it was 8 months later, and the doctors were saying, "Oh, we wish we had a liver for you. We wish we had a liver for you." And they put me on the transplant list. And then I just had to go regularly to the hospital still to be drained. And I had no other treatment than that, and just waiting for a transplant.
What was that like? I mean, I imagine you're looking at the phone thinking, is this going to be it?
No, I didn't think it would ever happen. I didn't think I deserved it, because I'd done it to myself. And I wasn't hoping for that. And I was grateful for their help, and they were very nice to me at the hospital, and they cared for me really well. But I thought it was the end of my life. And I waited 10 months. Until I had a phone call to say that I had a liver.
Remember your feelings when you heard that, when you got that phone call?
Yes, I know exactly. That was a Saturday afternoon. And they said, "Pack your bag, we'll send a taxi." And I said, "Oh, maybe tomorrow morning is early enough, you know, I'm cooking my dinner and so on." And I said, "No, the taxi is on its way, you come now." And by midnight I was under the knife at the operation.
And just talk me briefly through that. Was it, how big an operation was it? How long did it last? How did you feel when you recovered?
So on a Saturday evening, I was maybe in hospital by 7 o'clock or so. They said to me that it might still not be the right liver for me. So I had to be prepared that it might not go ahead. But then it just proceeded, and I think by 11:30 or so, they wheeled me into the operation theater. I think I woke only up a day and a half later, because they kept me sedated quite a long time. But when I woke up, it's really strange. I didn't think anything had happened, had changed really, you know. Only they said it went all ahead and it was fine, and it was. And to be quite honest, I had never had any trouble after that. 2.5 weeks later, I went home to recuperate and I never looked back. And now, 5 years later, I feel like it never happened. I know I've got a scar and I have to take the tablets, but I feel fitter and healthier than ever before.
And happier?
Much happier, much happier. I had counseling as well, and I needed that desperately because I've never dealt with the real problems why I started the drinking. And yeah, that helped. I'm still not quite there, to be quite honest. It's 5 years and it's a whole lifetime I have to digest. But yeah, I'm feeling very happy and positive now.
And how do you look back on the old you?
I was so irresponsible, and I thought I was a responsible person, looking after other people in my job, caring for my children, and being, and then neglecting myself so badly. But I think depressions, if you don't go through them, you don't know what they can do to you.
What do you think of alcohol now?
I miss it sometimes. I would like to share a glass of wine with friends or so because it's nice and I always enjoyed it, but I don't miss it. I know I can't drink with the medication and I don't want to go there again and I don't need to. So I'm quite happy without it, if that's the only thing.
The rather shocking story of Ingrid's battle with booze. To find out more about how alcohol can affect our liver and to try and get some advice on what we should do to protect it, I spoke to Andrew Langford, who's chief executive of the British Liver Trust. I asked him first what the liver actually does.
The liver is your detoxifier. And so with alcohol or drugs or whatever else, when that passes through the liver, if the liver is healthy and you're not drinking too much, then you will function normally. However, what can creep up on us, and it can be any of us, is if you start drinking just that little bit too much, that can get a little bit too much for the liver. And what will then start to happen is the liver won't be able to process all of the alcohol toxins, and that will then start to cause damage in the liver, and your liver will start to slow down in its processing. That eventually leads to scarring and what a lot of people refer to as cirrhosis. Once cirrhosis has happened, then it's very hard for the liver to repair itself. One of the luxuries that we all have is that with a healthy liver, if there is any damage, then quite often it can repair itself. But if that damage is to such an extent of cirrhosis, then that's when it becomes more difficult. And that's when people will start to get very ill, like Ingrid did. Unfortunately, in the early progression of liver disease, then sometimes there won't be any symptoms. And this is a great problem, is that your liver can be quite poorly, but there won't be anything going on in the rest of your body to tell you that. However, once you do start to get very ill, you will get the signs like Ingrid has described, that your tummy will swell and you'll have something called ascites. Sometimes your brain will be affected and you might have like a dementia-like illness. And generally, you will be starting to be feeling very poorly, very little energy, but that's very late stage.
How common is it? I mean, I believe it's something that's actually growing in this country.
It is. I mean, at the moment, liver disease is the third main cause of premature death in the UK. And it's the fifth biggest killer overall for all of us. So whether you're under 65 or over 65, it's a big problem. And of those big five killer diseases, liver disease is the only one that continues to increase. So we're managing to do things about heart disease and some cancers, but the one thing that we're not being able to do very much. What we approximate is that about 40 people a day die of liver disease.
And how much of that is caused by alcohol?
The majority of that will be caused by alcohol at the moment. There are other issues like obesity and viral hepatitis that can cause to end-stage liver disease. But by far, at the moment, the majority of people have got alcohol-related liver disease. And that's what a lot of those 40 will be dying from.
Well, the question is, how much alcohol causes liver disease?
I mean, it'll always be different for different people, but you know, we do have very safe guidelines. And definitely what we would be saying is for most men and women, no more than a glass of wine or a pint and a half to 2 pints of beer a day. Very importantly, it's very unhealthy for your liver to be drinking every day. So one of the things that we're always saying is, if you do choose to drink, at least take 2 to 3 consecutive days off every week. And that's when you will give your liver a chance to recuperate. Obviously, for the other days, you must drink sensibly and stay within the safe limits. What's happening is, increasingly, people are drinking a little bit more each day. That then becomes every day. And the classics are the mum who, once she's got the children to bed, opens a bottle of wine and ends up drinking that bottle of wine most days. The chap that, on his way home from work, might go for a couple of pints with his friends and then may have a little nightcap when he gets home. Or indeed, unfortunately, what we're seeing far more is a lot of elderly people that suddenly develop liver disease. And Ingrid's story is very reflective of that, that people who are lonely, that turn to drink, people that have issues with depression, and people that go under the radar because they're on their own, they're not causing anybody any problems, they're not like the teenage binge drinker on a Friday night causing havoc. They are people, as I say, that go under the radar. And it's, again, because there aren't any symptoms of liver disease, as in Ingrid's case, you might find out a little bit too late.
Well, I think that is the most worrying thing, perhaps, that you don't know it's happening.
It's a big problem. It really is a big problem that we still see far too many people diagnosed very late in their liver disease. And that's why we're always asking that there needs to be better screening, particularly by GPs. People need to look at their lifestyles. One of the things that we do at the British Liver Trust is we have a very easy to fill in questionnaire, which is available on our website. And that really assesses your risks. And that should be a trigger point for you knowing. If you're honest in your answers, you will get a very honest printout that will give you advice, but very importantly, will tell you what you need to talk to your GP about. The liver, as I say, can be a fantastic organ and it can recuperate, but once it's too damaged, that's what, you know, what we see is far more people with very advanced liver disease. And Ingrid was very lucky. She got a transplant. Unfortunately, still, we don't have enough organs for everybody to get a transplant. So that's why we're seeing more than 40 people a day die. As I said earlier, you know, alcohol-related liver disease really can affect any of us. Some people will be alcoholics, but not everyone. Some people will be just people that are drinking too much every day.
And finally, what's your key message to people listening, maybe people of my age, middle-aged, in their 40s, 50s? What should we be doing?
My advice to all of us is firstly, sit down quietly on your own and complete the British Liver Trust questionnaire, which is available on www.loveyourliver.org.uk. Be honest in your answers. It's completely anonymous. And it'll assess your risks of 3 types of liver disease, not only alcohol-related liver disease, but also obesity-related liver disease and viral hepatitis. You'll then be able to have a printout which will tell you exactly what your risks are. So I think that's a great starting point.
Andrew Langford from the British Liver Trust. If you want to contact them, their website is britishlivertrust.org.uk, and that has lots of information and details of support groups. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. If you want to contact us about that or anything else, you can email us. The address is healthtodayradio@nhs.net. Now, falling is something that can happen to anyone, but it's more likely to happen to you if you're an older person. Around 1 in 3 adults over 65 who live at home will have at least 1 fall a year, and about half will have more. Most falls don't result in serious injury, but even if they don't lead to broken bones, falls can really knock people's confidence in their ability to carry on living an independent life. But there are things we can do to reduce the risk of falling, and one of the most important is to use exercise to improve our balance and what's called core strength. Isabel Eaton went along to a falls prevention exercise class at Carn in Wiltshire to learn more.
Okay, so we are going to make a start. We are going to do some work.
My name's Rosie Golding, and I'm actually a fitness instructor with Wiltshire Council, as well as their walks coordinator for the county. And I deliver on specialist falls and balance classes. It's a falls prevention class, but also it covers quite a wide range of issues. GPs can refer clients into it, physios can refer into it, but people can self-refer. So we're covering people that have had falls and are recovering from them, and we're going to try and get them rehabilitated from the shock and the effects of a fall. It covers also people that have got this fear of falling, and that takes on a much wider group. So what I want you to do is move your bottoms forward to the very front of the chair and get into what we know is a good posture position.
So my name is Kate Blackburn. I'm a public health specialty registrar with Wiltshire Council, and one of my areas of work is around bone health and falls prevention. The reason that older people are more prone to falls is because we have certain things that happen in our bodies that change as we age, to do with muscle mass. It becomes more common that people are physically inactive as they become older. So we have reduced amount of muscle predominantly in the lower limbs and the legs, which can really impact upon a person's strength and also their balance. In addition, there are certain health conditions that become more common as we age, things like low blood pressure, heart disease, and dementia. And these can also really impact on a person's sense of dizziness, on their strength. There are a number of other things as we age that can affect us. Our reflexes tend to slow down. So if you suddenly find yourself off balance, it's much harder to recover from that, which leaves you far more at risk of falling. And some of the other things as we age, such as our sight, can start to deteriorate. And so if you can't see obstacles that are in your way, again, it heightens your risk of falling.
And I just want you to place your hands on the side of the chair. And I want you just to push a little bit of weight through them so that you become very straight. Remember, posture is key to balance. Everything we do is evidence-based. All the exercises are proven to assist in preventing falls. So we work on the big muscles in the legs and the upper body, because obviously you need upper body strength in order to do your everyday living. But also we teach all our clients a few strategies about how to help themselves, situations to avoid, what not to do, as well as what to do. So we're a double-edged sword, really. And we try and give them advice and point them in the right direction, as well as developing their muscle mass in their lower limbs to hopefully reduce falls. And now I want you to think about pulling your upper body out of your hips and straightening up. Don't hold your breath. Breathe normally.
I'm Eve Charnock.
Eve, why do you come along to this class?
Well, I've had quite a few heart attacks, and they've recommended I have exercises. I've been coming here for about 2 or 3 years.
Have you had any trouble with stability and falls?
I do fall down. I fell down last week. But I'm all right anyway. So they recommend I come to these exercises.
And does it help?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think they just help, actually.
What sort of exercises do you do?
Well, I sit down. I can't walk round unless I've got my walker to walk with, so I just sit down and do them.
It isn't high impact, but it is very specific. It's specific to certain muscles in the body, but it's the regularity of it. And you have to remember, all these people are sent home with an exercise book, and we encourage them to do the exercise 2 or 3 times a week on their own. I know it's difficult, but a lot of them do that, and you can tell, because it's the ongoing basis of the exercise and the regularity of it that helps them increase their muscle mass. They're not going to increase it massively, but they'll increase it enough to keep themselves independent and mobile and safe. What I want you to do is remain where you are, but push your feet back slightly towards the chair. And I want you to hold on to the sides of the chair.
So you have the immediate impact of a fall, which is a physical impact. It can be bruising or broken bones, which can be terribly painful and can also hinder how you can manage your day-to-day activities. I think really, though, the biggest impact tends to be the psychological impact of a fall. It can be very scary and tends to knock people's confidence enormously. We know from research and evidence that people can feel very frightened about leaving their own home after a fall, which means that they can become very isolated, which has a very detrimental impact on their, not just their physical, but their mental health. And in some cases, can lead to people going into long-term care prematurely because they just feel unable anymore to cope with those day-to-day activities.
Okay, this time I want you to push yourselves up
and I want you to elegantly rise so and stretch yourselves to your full height.
I would say that fear of falling is a massive problem. Falling is a problem. It isn't just the physical injuries that people sustain from falls. It is the after effects. It's the fear of going out, of being in a situation where they have not got any support, nothing to hang on to. And that can actually have a hugely detrimental effect on an elderly person's social life as well. If you take that one step further, if they're frightened of going out, particularly going out on their own, they are in extreme danger of becoming isolated. They will go out less, they will mix less. So it has ramifications that we probably don't realise. Excellent, okay. We're going to continue to raise the heart rate a little. I want you all to stand side onto your chair. And I want you to cuddle up close. It's your best friend. Remember, the chair is there to support you, so use it as much as you need to.
My name's Kathleen Ball.
I come
because I enjoy it and it does you good. And I thoroughly enjoy the exercise and it keeps me mobile as well. They keep telling us to go and do exercise and walks, and that's what I try and do.
So you really think that these exercises help to keep you stable?
Yes, I do. I do. The other ones, and Rosie, she makes them sit and watch before they do any exercise, and she knows if we've got any problems with her, she won't let us do the exercise.
And you do a fair amount of exercises around and sitting on the chair, so you've always got something to hold on to, is that right?
Yes, we have the chairs and we walk around the chairs as well, yeah.
So no need for anyone to feel anxious?
No, not at all.
And is it fun?
It is fun, and we do have a laugh as well. It is absolutely brilliant. I'd thoroughly recommend it.
The advantage of doing this and working these muscles and being able to pick the legs up is if you should get an audition to join a dancing troupe, you will be first in line. You'll be fine. We've got some amazing results from these false classes, amazing. And also, everything we do is based on things they need to do in their everyday living. So we will teach them how to bend correctly, so that they can continue to bend to a lower cupboard to pick something up, and equally how to reach safely, so that they can reach for things without being in danger themselves.
And is it fun?
Absolutely. Sidestepping. That's it, Rose. Lovely.
Isabel Eaton in Cannes. You're listening to Health Today, I'm Dominic Arkwright. In a couple of earlier programmes, we talked about some common skin conditions, including eczema. You can find them by searching the NHS Choices website. Well, today, we've been back to Dr. William Porter, consultant dermatologist at the Gloucester Royal Infirmary, to talk about psoriasis, a condition which affects around 1 in 50 people in the UK. It usually causes red, flaky patches of skin, and it may just be a mild irritation, but it can be long-lasting and very unpleasant and have a serious impact on people's lives. I asked Dr. Porter to outline what psoriasis actually is.
Psoriasis is often a lifelong skin affliction, and it usually presents with lots of scaly, sometimes itchy, red patches on limbs, but basically can affect you anywhere, including your scalp and your nails.
And what does it look like? How will it affect my appearance?
It usually looks like a well-defined patch, usually symmetrical, so both sides of your body. Usually has a bit of scale or dry skin over the surface or around the edges. Often it isn't itchy, but it is of some cosmetic significance to most patients.
What causes it?
It's not really known, but it appears to be a strong genetic factor involved, though the specific area on your genetic coding hasn't been refined yet, shall we say.
So partly genetic, but otherwise...
Well, yeah, there can be some things in one's environment that can precipitate it. Certainly some medicines can provoke it, beta blockers, for instance, and some drugs like lithium. And occasionally it can be brought on by excesses of smoking and drinking, but those aren't the causes. They're more provoking factors.
When you have psoriasis, is it always there or does it come and go?
Well, there's an enormous variety of presentation for anyone with psoriasis. It can come and go. It can be with you in short, sharp shocks, or you can have it all the time. And the severity can also vary enormously.
So if it did come and go in short, sharp shocks, what might bring on one of the flare-ups?
Well, one of the versions of psoriasis, of which there are many, is guttate psoriasis, and this is often provoked by a sore throat, for instance. And it can then leave you lots of little spots all over your body, scaly little spots, which can last 2 or 3 months. In some people, it can go on to become long-term. But there are occasions where it will just go away on its own accord, and you don't need much in the way of treatment.
Who gets it? You mentioned a genetic factor, but is it specific to men or women or children or adults?
Anyone can get it, but the most commonly affected people are those in their 20s at first presentation or in their 50s. But anyone at any age can get it. It's rarer in children, though I do see a few, and it's rarer in the elderly as a first presentation.
I wonder why that would be then, 20s or 50s and not in between.
Hard to say. Must be a genetic provocation in those instances, but as I say, we're not sure.
Does it hurt?
No, not usually. It can be itch. It can be itchy. It can be sore, but there usually isn't any pain involved.
So how can it affect people's lives? I mean, you must see a lot of people here. What is the kind of range of effects that it can have?
Well, physically, you know, it can be very embarrassing. So there's a lot of psychological problems associated with it. It can be uncomfortable and crack and be sore, but the disfigurement is perhaps the most worrying thing for most people with psoriasis. Other symptoms can also include arthritis that can be associated with it, and that can be, I suppose, a painful thing, but it's not the skin manifestation.
So it must be pretty terrible for a young person if it's appearing on your face, for example. Mm.
Yes, it can be awful. It can, you know, prevent them from undressing in public, going swimming, etc., and have an enormous amount of complications with their social life, and can make people quite introverted as a result.
And presumably affect, if you're young, your school life and your school work, and if you're older, your work life.
Very much so,
Tell me about that.
Well, you'd become consumed not only with the condition, but also with the treatments as well. You know, you're often having to see your doctor regularly. You need time out for your topical treatments and or other things a dermatologist might prescribe you. And often it will make you, as I say, introverted, not want to leave the house much. So your social and working life will suffer.
Do people, can it make people leave their jobs? Tell me how bad it can get.
Well, the range again is very unpredictable. The severity will dictate what sort of jobs they'll do quite often. For instance, you don't get many lifeguards who have got very bad psoriasis, but you do have people with very mild disease whom it doesn't affect at all. Some people with very severe disease can be very ill with it as well. I should perhaps mention that, and they will struggle at work and socially.
Say more about that. Ill how?
Well, there is a version of psoriasis when you become what we call erythrodermic, when all of your skin is very red. And you can be very ill with this, particularly if you have other conditions. You can be dehydrated and have heating problems and get infections more readily. And the treatments we give for this can also make you quite ill. So that in itself is a worry to dermatologists.
Well, there's not a cure, is there? But presumably there is quite a range of treatment that you can offer.
There's an enormous range, starting with creams, going through to light therapies, tablets to suppress your immune system, and also these days there's a whole range of very powerful injections that we can provide.
Is there anything that I can do in my life, in my lifestyle, that will either prevent or ease the pain of psoriasis?
Not a great deal, no. I mean, you stick to treatments that you're prescribed by your GP, but there are associations with psoriasis, like high blood pressure and high cholesterol and heart disease and kidney disease, that you need to address. So it's sensible not to drink much alcohol, not to smoke, and to look after yourself, as you should do anyway, because all of those other associations I mentioned can, of course, impact on your life and your health.
What have I missed, or what would you like to say that we haven't done?
If you are struggling with your GP and your psoriasis is not improving, you should ask for a dermatology consultation.
ask your GP for one to refer you.
Yes, absolutely. We've got far more range of treatments and more confidence and more experience with treating patients with psoriasis.
Consultant dermatologist Dr. William Porter. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright.
Jimmy, come. Jimmy, sit. Sit, good boy. And down. Down.
Let me introduce you to Jimmy and his owner, Zandra Highland. Jimmy is part Chihuahua, part Yorkshire Terrier, and part Jack Russell. He's 3 years old, and he has a job. Every week, Jimmy and Zandra visit an old people's home in Cirencester in Gloucestershire as an exponent of what's called pets as therapy. Dogs, and cats apparently, can play an important role in bringing comfort and companionship to people. It's organised by a charity called Pets as Therapy, and I'll give you some contact details in a moment if you think your pet might be up to the job. But first, let's find out what Jimmy does and how he goes down with the people he visits.
Well, Jimmy is an amazing little lapdog, really, and he just loves to greet people when we meet them outside. If they don't want to say hello to him, he's quite hurt. But I realised that he was marvellous with old and infirm people when I visited an old friend of mine in the road down here. And it, although she had her own dog, he went on her bed and she would stroke him and she would always start to smile and it cheered her up no end. She couldn't remember his name ever because she had Alzheimer's, but that didn't matter. That made me realise that he was good at that, so I just asked if I could go to Ashley House, where I used to go with the Border Terrier, and started to put into procedure to get qualified by Pets as Therapy. But the old lady, he visited her and lay on her bed just a few hours before she passed away, and she actually just woke up enough to smile and stroke him, which was amazing.
And tell me about his character. What's he like?
Well, he's a dear little thing, terribly affectionate, and he wants to be top dog all the time to me, which he's not allowed to be, really, because the other one is. But he's very affectionate, he's very amusing, and he enjoys everything, meeting other dogs, and particularly likes meeting children and older people outside and chasing squirrels.
But do you think he has a gift with older people?
Oh, yes, I think he has, definitely. He seems to know exactly what to do. He really does, to make them happy, to let them stroke him and gaze at them and wag his tail, which is like a plume.
And what do you think are the qualities that are needed to be a therapeutic dog?
Well, I think they need to be quiet and gentle, but they do need to make eye contact. I think this is, as long as the person can see, this is a great thing, and to like being stroked.
When did you decide that he was the right kind of chap to do this job?
I suppose about 8 months ago now, after, because he used to visit my old friend down the road a lot, and I thought, well, I'd like to do that. It used to be so beneficial for the people in the nursing home and for me. It was amazing what I did with the Border Terrier.
Because you had a previous dog who did this. What was he like?
Oh, it was a she. She was Poppy. She was a dark-coloured Border Terrier, and she just seemed to know what to do. She was amazing. Can I tell you two stories about her? Which one... Well, there was a gentleman who'd had a stroke, who was completely disabled down one side, and he sat with his back to the open door in his room. And he did not want to see a dog because he'd had to leave his own dog at home. So we used to walk past, and every time she'd look in, she would look in the door. And one day she looked in so much, I just let go of the lead. And she went in, and the next thing is she was standing beside him, in front of him, gazing at him. He was smiling, and with his good arm he was stroking her. I mean, it was amazing. So he wanted to see her every time after that. And the other thing she did, which I'll never forget, was a lady she used to visit in bed who was pretty poorly, but quite could talk and everything. And she had a severe stroke, and I didn't know that. She was being wheeled towards us in her wheelchair down the passage with a nurse. And I said to the nurse, would she like to see Poppy? And the nurse said, yes. I picked up Poppy and held her towards her lap, not to put her down on her. And the lady put her arms out and grabbed hold of Poppy's hands, or took hold of Poppy's legs, and said, Poppy, I love you. And the nurse broke into tears. She said that's the first time she's spoken since the stroke. Well, that was amazing. That really was amazing. I realised that this, you know, the dogs had something that we haven't got. We can't give them. But this little one has had equally amazing experiences just in the 6 months we've been doing it, actually.
Like?
Well, the most sort of... wonderful one in a way, was a lady who couldn't see, couldn't hear, couldn't speak, and she was just sort of immobile. And the lady who came around with me said, oh, I know she used to have dogs, let's put Jimmy sort of on her lap. And the lady took hold of the lady's hand, the patient's hand, and sort of went to stroke Jimmy's back, which is very, very soft. And this lady started to smile. Absolutely amazing. We did that twice. Sadly, she's now moved on. Well, that was amazing.
I'm Catherine Davis, and I'm the activity coordinator here at Ashley House.
Now, I've met a little fella called Jimmy, and he certainly talks a good game. Is he up to the job?
He's a very good pat dog. He comes in and he'll just run up to any resident that wants to see him and jumps on their lap. He's adorable.
What kind of qualities has he got, do you think?
He's a friendly, loving, warm dog, and he's very sociable, which is a very important thing, and he enjoys it.
What does the day job of being a pet therapeutic dog involve? What do you do?
It means going to places like our care home or hospitals, schools, anywhere like that. And it's just about visiting people who maybe don't have access to pets themselves, so they get the benefits of stroking a pet or being around an animal that they wouldn't necessarily be able to do otherwise.
And do you think animals can give something that humans can't?
Definitely. They give unconditional love, which is something that we generally don't do.
Jimmy, come. Jim. Come on, Jimmy. Come on, up on chair. Up. Up. Come on. Good boy. And sit. There you are.
Okay, Jimmy comes in, obviously with Zandra, every Tuesday morning. Comes in for an hour because after an hour, to be honest, that's quite enough for a dog. Some people just want a quick stroke. Other people want to sit with him kind of on their lap for 5-10 minutes. So we get around as many people as we can in that time. And if Jimmy wants to leave, he tells us he wants to leave. So he guides it, really.
And does he have some favourites?
He does, yes. We're going to meet one of them later.
Jean Neal.
And you've met Jimmy. What's he like?
Oh, he's beautiful. He's very friendly. He comes in and he wants to sit on my lap. And he's quite a big dog. And he's lovely.
So what happens when he comes?
Oh, we just sit and talk. And he looks intelligent and I just sit.
He's got a lovely coat, hasn't he? He's very nice to touch.
He's beautiful, yes. And he's so intelligent too.
Do you look forward to him coming?
Oh, yes. Rather, yes.
Do you think he gives something that humans don't?
Well, yes, they do. There's no doubt about that. They don't talk to you in human voices, but they let you know what they want and what they don't want. He knows he's coming, you know, and he's great.
So what does his day job involve, and how often does he do it?
Well, we only do it once a week. I think that's enough. We see sort of between 12 and 20 people individually.
In a day?
We only go for an hour and a bit, so they don't have long. We see some in the reception area when I have to pick him up and put them on their laps and they stroke him and whatever. And otherwise we go in their rooms and put him on their lap. And a lot of people have had dogs and they start talking about their dogs, showing me pictures of their own dogs. But he just loves it, Jimmy. I have to admit, some laps he finds more comfortable than others. They need to have quite long legs and perhaps a blanket on their lap. But he doesn't mind. He just loves it. And sometimes he just turns around, curls up and goes to sleep on their lap. But they all say, oh, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. It makes me feel very small.
You feel better?
Oh, yes. I definitely feel better for having seen him because he gives so much. You know, he's great. Yeah.
I can't really expand on that. It's inexplicable. You've kind of just got to see it. It's the natural reaction when humans see animals to light up and get happiness from it.
Do they have to be specially trained or do they have to be kind of interviewed and vetted to get the job?
Yeah, there's a charity called Pets as Therapy. They're a national charity and they do all the vetting. People can approach them if they've got a dog and they've got the time and want to go around to see people. The dogs do have to go through some kind of induction process, I suppose, and they're vetted, as it were. They have to go to a vet, literally, to make sure they do certain things or they're appropriate for visiting people. Obviously, not all dogs are suitable for being a pets as therapy dog. They need to be able to be gentle because obviously in our situation, it's a case of skin tears and stuff with claws. You don't want anyone pawing or jumping up at people. I think being gentle is probably the most important characteristic for the pat dogs to have.
The charming Jimmy and his owner, Zandra Hyland, bringing some companionship to Jean at Ashley House Nursing Home in Cirencester. You can contact Pets as Therapy if you want. Their website is petsastherapy.org. Before we go, you know we like to give people a chance to show their gratitude to someone who's helped them in their life or with their health, something we're not always able to do at the time and sometimes wish we had. Today I asked Ingrid, who you'll remember had a liver transplant 5 years ago caused by excessive drinking. This is her thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the donor family for giving me the gift of the liver. I never knew that lady. I know she was from the Midlands and she died, I think, in a car accident. That's the only news they ever gave me about it. And I mean, I'm eternally grateful for that gift of life. And then it's Dr. Graham and Alexander and the Addenbrookes Hospital. They were just so excellent in my care. And to this day, when I go back for checkups, and I think without them, I would have never made it. So the biggest thank you right from the heart. Thank you.
Next time we're talking about children's teeth. That's been in the news recently. Also chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. And we meet a woman who helps children cope with radiotherapy. She's a play specialist. That and more in our next programme. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Thank you for listening. Stay well.
The opinions expressed in this programme are the individual's own personal opinion and do not reflect the views or official policy of the Department of Health or NHS Choices. This programme was clinically reviewed in July 2015.